This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, AfterBuzzers, before we move on to your next topic, we just want to say thanks to our sponsor, Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. Plus, there are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Also, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Plus, you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor FM to get started.
Straight off the heels of HBO's True Detective, we have actress Emily Nelson in studio. Stay tuned.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Spotlight On. I am your host, Tammy Gouveia, and we have in studio with us Emily Nelson.
Yay! Applause, applause, applause!
So excited to have you here.
Oh, my gosh. I'm excited to be here. Thank
you. Oh, my
you.
Gosh. Before we dive into all things True Detective,
yes.
Because that's probably going to be the majority of the show. And for the audience, this is also a podcast. So people can get a visual of us, but, this is also a podcast. Mm-hmm. So for all of our listeners, if you haven't viewed True Detective yet, season 3.
Yeah, this is going to be full of spoiler alerts. So,
I'm just going to ask you, is it okay to, as long as we say spoiler alert?
I think so. I mean, honestly, nobody gave me a handbook on this situation,
okay.
So I don't know. But I think that it's out there.
It's out
and
there.
It's like if you go to Reddit, everybody's talking about what's happening. So I don't know why we shouldn't. I refrained from doing it before an episode came out, trying to protect what information I did have.
Right.
But good. I feel like it's all out there now.
Perfect. And, that makes it so easy then.
And what's great is that people can come back and watch, they can hit pause right now or when we start to talk about True Detective and they come back and watch it or listen to it after they've seen the show.
See, you're so much smarter than me.
I mean,
I don't know about that. We'll try to remember the spoiler alert part.
Right?
You have a very extensive background. So why don't we start, with the fun little things, like where you're from.
Okay.
What inspired you? Like, how did you get onto this creative journey?
So I grew up the early part of my childhood in Pittsburgh, and then the second part of my childhood, sort of like 10 years old and on, in Oak Park, Illinois, which is right next to Chicago. And this is going to sound absurd because I'm 5 feet, 1 inch tall, but I was really into basketball.
Really?
I wasn't.
So you've always had lofty dreams.
Literally, yeah. But here's the thing is I wasn't a short kid. I was taller than everybody else, or at least average, until everybody else got tall. So like in middle school, I don't have a short complex. It doesn't occur to me that I'm little. Like nobody ever thinks I'm little. So whereas some of my friends who are similar height to me, they're always in heels. Like they feel small. I just don't feel that way. And I think it's because I was pretty average height growing up and until about freshman year of high school when all of a sudden everybody hits their growth spurt and mine just didn't come in the mail.
God.
So
I
it
was
never
the
happened.
Exact same way.
Yeah, you too, right?
Yeah, I figured I had 4 years left. In high school, I was going to get at least another 2 inches.
Yeah.
Nothing.
I mean, at least I surpassed my mom, so I feel like evolution
I didn't.
Is...
I got my grandma's little short. Because my dad was 6'1", my mom was 5'8", and I'm 5'3".
What?
I know.
No.
Genetics.
Genetic
Go
travesty.
Figure.
Oh,
anyway.
Well, you know what? There's a lot of benefits to being little, and I think you know that. I just walk under things. I never have to duck. I get tall people to do stuff for me,
All the time.
I use the phrase, hey, you want to play be tall guy for me? And anybody will answer to that because they feel like I'm complimenting them. And really, I'm just observing. It's neither this way nor that, right? So anyways, okay. So living, Oak Park was like literally just 3 blocks from Chicago. So when I was about 15, well, let me back up the reason I brought up basketball. So the summer before freshman year of high school, I went to basketball camp. And that's when I discovered that I have no business being a forward. I had a mean layup, you guys, mean layup. And suddenly I was being towered over, and I was not fast enough to be a point guard. So my sports career was pretty much over, and the coach was quite mean to me.
Oh.
And I really, I kind of, you know, I took it hard. So once school started, I started playing tennis. My family played tennis. So that was, I was much better suited for that. So that was kind of my high school sport. And great, what was great about tennis was that it ended early in the year. And so then I was available to do theater. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go do a play or whatever. And the, I went to a public high school, Oak Park River Forest High School. And they had 3 theaters in there. One sat 2,000, one sat 500.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, one sat 200. I went to Carnegie Mellon University eventually, which is one of the top drama schools. I got very, very lucky. That was all almost accidental that I ended up there. But they had 2 tiny little theaters, nothing compared to this. So I got really spoiled in the sense that if you wanted to do theater, you had so many opportunities. Yeah. We did like 11 shows a year, and you could be in at least half of those if you wanted to.
It's so bizarre because I feel like we grew up in parallel universes.
Oh, yeah?
Because I went to an all-girls high school. So to meet boys, I went and did theater at the boys' high schools.
That makes
sense.
And
their theater, you know, sat 2,500. And it was like full-on professional stuff.
Yeah, and it was like 60 feet up to the grid. And 60 feet. Like when they flew in Oklahoma, they like flew in
Oklahoma.
Yeah. So ours was the same thing. And their shop was gigantic and huge. It was all built in the 60s under this guy named Mr. Itram, who graduated or who retired after my freshman year. So I got like that end bit of like inspiration, you know, and when you're young, you know, it seems so exciting. And so, you know, the theater and, you know, it's just very romantic. The theater is just, it's a wonderful place to expand who you are and what you dream of and what's possible. You know, when, this is a little silly, but I used to spend a lot of time, I used to like to think of conundrums, like problems that had no answer. Mm. I think it was before cell phones, I needed something to do. And I would think about like, which is more expansive, the theater or my own mind? Like, which could you actually create more in? Do you know what I mean? And I guess what I meant was like, in my own mind, I can fly, I can turn into a fish, like you can do whatever you want in your mind. But in the theater, there's collaboration. And there's ideas and connections and creativity that other people will introduce to your imagination that you would have never thought of on your own. So maybe that's more creative, you know? So I don't know. I was just really, I was just really interested in just the expanse of what's possible. And I found it very inspiring. So anyways, that's how I ended up in the theater.
So that you got the bug.
Got the bug.
You got the bug.
And then I started going to Second City when I was 15.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And that was a crazy time 15? Back then. Yeah.
So you weren't intimidated by...
I mean, in a fun kind of way.
Youth.
Yeah,
I'll
you
do
know,
it.
Yeah, exactly, right? So when I showed up, they had a high school program, but everybody in it was about to graduate or was already just in college. So I was the youngest person. And those people literally ended up being my teacher, Francis Collier, Todd Stashwick, who are all huge names now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all still friends. In fact, Todd married into my family, which is a whole nother
That's another show.
Yeah. But he's my cousin-in-law now. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so crazy. So that really was like the work that I did at Second City. And we had a little traveling company as high school students. So we had class, but then we would go around to different high schools and do workshops and pull scenes from the touring company and from main stage and do that work ourselves. And
but theater. Yeah. You know, plays and Second City, they're two different worlds.
Not really.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so
at
all.
How are they connected?
Well, because of the imagination. You know, improvisation is something out of nothing, right? And so if I see it, you see it. If I believe in it, you believe in it. And really, the only difference between improvisation and a play is that in a play, I'm incorporating more given circumstances. So I'm incorporating words that I've been given. I'm incorporating costumes and blocking. But as far as the life force that is required for me to believe in what I'm doing, it's the same function of the imagination. It's just that at Second City, in their form of improvisation, we would use space work for props. So I would be so clear about what I was doing. I would, you know, reach and open a refrigerator, but I did it so specifically that your mind would start to see the refrigerator, right? That's what great improvisers do, is they show you what they're seeing. And so In some ways, it seems like a really great parlor trick, but it's essentially the same mechanism. I mean, even if you give me lines, I'm still improvising the inner life of the character.
Absolutely.
I'm still, if you and I are in a scene together, I'm still, every time we do the scene, it's going to be infinitesimally different. Because if I'm really listening to what you're saying.
It can't be the same.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm responding. So we have to have a level of spontaneity and improvisation in our work as actors just to keep it alive, to keep it true, to keep it honest. And that's what the audience is going to connect to.
Yes.
Because if we're not being honest, they're going to tune out. They're not going to be engaged.
It's amazing because I think so often actors do, like me, you know, have that divide. Mm. I was terrified to take my first improv class.
I know, a lot of people
like,
are.
Like, I can't do this. You know, I can give me a script. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. if I don't have that and I'm just have to rely on my imagination and just say yes and mm-hmm. regardless.
Bah! No, I understand. I mean, it's, you know, you're stepping into the void.
Yeah.
Like there's plenty to be, excuse me, there's plenty to be nervous about. But it is one of those things that you sort of just trust stepping off the diving board, you know, and you just do it enough times that you realize that, you know, the moment will catch you. Creativity will catch you. Something will come.
Speaking of the support, it sounds like you had a lot of support in Second City.
I did.
Again, being so young,
yeah.
that's pretty vital for you to
yeah.
continue to stay inspired and mm-hmm. grow and continue on.
Yeah. I mean, it was a wild time. Like the, you know, the comedian Brett Gelman, he was in there with me. Jeffrey Brown, who's an actor here. So it's funny, like a lot of us are now in LA and we see each other. In fact, Brett was at the premiere for True Detective and I would have found him and I was like, Brett, you know, so that was really fun. But yeah, you know, I think we just got lucky. We were just in this moment there where the training center hadn't really turned into kind of the mass situation that it is now.
Yeah.
And so we were sort of forgotten about in a way. Like we had our own little, but their training is very serious. They take Viola Spolin's work very seriously and very much to heart. But we also partied pretty hard. I won't even say some of the things that went down because I look back on it now and I'm like, that's crazy.
You know, it's funny, and it's I don't crazy. Know why I make this correlation, but it kind of reminds me of the early days of SNL.
No, it was a little like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just that we were under it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some dark things that happened, you know, that tend to happen when they just, you know, the world is a mixed place of, like, a lot of things. And, you know, not to me personally, but it, you know, life is can be dangerous.
Yeah.
You know,
you
and
see
so,
things, yeah.
Yeah. And so it was the cornerstone of what I do, of how I teach now, of the way I approach my own performances. Those people are still my friends. I have the most wonderful memories from it. I had a lot of crazy experiences.
That you can draw from now.
Yeah. I mean, the woman that owned Second City had a cabin up on Lake Michigan. And we would go up there for retreats and like...
For podcast people, the retreats has the
Oh, yeah,
little,
has some quotes around it.
Has the
Thank
quotes
you.
Around
yeah.
it, yes.
I made silent quotes. Was not appropriate for this. But, you know, which was basically a party. We were basically just up there partying together. And, yeah, I'm glad we all got out alive.
How did you transition from Second City to L.A.?
Well, okay, so long story short... The summer between my junior year of high school and junior and senior year of high school, I was a little bit of a grouchy teenager, maybe.
Okay.
And I just needed to get out of town. Like, the idea of one more summer in Oak Park was, like, the end of it.
I can't breathe.
Yeah, I just really, yeah. you know, maybe I was a little bit of a drama queen, maybe. I don't know. I can't really recall.
You said it.
Yeah, luckily there was no video of it, but I think my parents might have something to say about that. So I think they were pretty, like, looking forward to find an opportunity to, like, send me somewhere. So I had heard about this girl who had gone to Georgetown for a theater program. And I'd heard of Georgetown and
yeah.
I knew it was good school, but who goes to Georgetown for theater? Nobody. You go for poli sci
right.
or whatever. So of course I signed up for it. It was canceled at the last minute due to lack of interest, which totally makes sense now. And I freaked out. And my mother said, well, when we lived in Pittsburgh, when you were a little girl, your grandparents used to go see plays at this place called Carnegie Mellon. Why don't you see if they have a drama program?
Oh,
turns out next to Juilliard, it's one of the oldest drama
yeah.
programs in the country. So it turns out they did. They had already closed their six-week program. I begged them. I sent them this absurdly long resume because I'd worked on so many shows. I'd done costumes. I was literally a spear carrier, spear in a play. You know, I'd done everything a person could do. And they let me in for whatever reason. So I went and I did the 6 weeks in Pittsburgh.
Did you cry when you, did you get a letter, like that acceptance letter, or was it a phone call? Like, do you remember?
Well, not, I don't remember about going to the 6 weeks program, but all I know is that once we got there, they told us every week that this was the best school, that none of us are going to get in. And they were really conceited about it. And I thought, you know, if you're that people who are great don't really
don't
mention
talk about it.
You know
what
I mean? So I was sort of like on to them. I feel, I was like, And so every week he'd be like, who wants to go to school here? And everybody would raise their hand in like the drama lit class. And he'd be like, who doesn't? And I would raise my hand. And he's like, why not? And I'd mentioned that you guys seem a little hyped up. And I also pointed out that even though I thought the training was fantastic, the teachers, the point of that program was to tell you whether or not they thought you should pursue being a professional actor, like whether it was worth your time and your money, because they were constantly trying to discourage us. They were always saying, if there's something else you can do, go do
it. I really appreciate that.
I do too. I say it to my students now. I teach at AMDA and I have my own studio, and I'm like, I'm not here to bum you guys out, but literally, if you think you're going to be a good veterinarian, go do it.
Yeah.
Just please. Because this is hard. This is hard for everybody. You know, we like to have fun and be glamorous, but the hustle is real,
absolutely, know? And the pros make it look easy.
They do.
That's why everybody, you know, walks away like, oh, I can do that. Oh,
yeah,
I can do that.
Oh. Yeah. Go ahead. Go,
go
on.
Ahead. Go ahead. I dare you.
We need more traffic.
Go ahead.
Come on. But we're all transplants. We
I
all
know.
Took that risk.
We are.
You know. So, but the thing was, is so they because of that they were giving attention to the girls who looked like women already. I mean, we were 16.
Yeah.
So the girls with blonde hair and big boobs and a womanly figure were getting all of the, you're great, you're great, you're great. And so I just was very blunt about it. I said, I find that absurd. I'm like, this is a room full of 16-year-olds. Most of us don't look like the adults we're going to turn into. So you have no idea who we're going to be or what's going to become. And I think it's a really, it's a false hope for these girls. I don't know why you're doing it. It makes, to me, it makes no sense. And so at the end, they made us all audition. And I said, I'm not going to school here. I didn't fill out an application. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I was going to go back to Chicago, go back to Second City, maybe go to DePaul. That was my plan. And I left. The 6 weeks was over, came back to Chicago. On my birthday at the end of August, I get a letter in the mail. This is before senior year of high school, saying, congratulations, you've been accepted to the Carnegie Mellon Drama Department. But this is all true. But then it says in bold capital letters, not the acting option, the directing option, which was even crazier because nobody told me there was a directing major. I straight up didn't know. It just didn't occur to me you could go to college to be a director. So it turns out they took six people a year for that.
Okay.
And through a series of arguments with my parents, because the school was very expensive. And I was like, why would I go to school to be a poor theater director? Why would I pay $100,000 for it? Just made, you know.
You were so pragmatic.
I was. I was
Holy
very
mackerel.
Pragmatic, very political, very, you know, I spoke my mind. But at this point, my parents had figured out how prestigious the school was. And
they're thinking big picture.
Yeah.
It's like, girl.
And
come
so my
on.
Dad got in a, and I got in a yelling fight about it one night. And at some point, he screams, well, fine, I'll pay for it. And I said, fine. And then we just walked away. And that's what happened. I got lucky. I got lucky. I had a parent who somehow figured out. I found out later all the loans were in my name. But he did pay them off. So thank you, Dad. Thank you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have friends who are still paying off their loans. So, you know, blessings and you got to be ready for those opportunities. But I haven't done it all by myself.
That's a
I've
great
had a
point.
Lot of a lot of support. So so my senior year of high school was hilarious. I took electricity. I never took the SATs. I took electricity.
You checked out.
I started doing professional shows in Chicago. That was when I first started acting professionally because now I had time on my hands. And then I went to school there as director. The first 7 weeks, they mixed us all up, actors, musical theater, production design. And they made us take each other's classes in hopes that we would become friends because it's a conservatory. You get very sort of tunnel visioned. And to an extent, it worked, but it was sort of hilarious because, like, me in a design class was absurd. Like, we had to, you know, make a sculpture of a, you know, a self portrait. And mine was like literally paper mache hands with like colored paper, you know, and other people are coming in with like full on Davids and works of art. Like, you could really tell who was in the right class and who wasn't. But I had a little chip on my shoulder because at the time, Carnegie Mellon was very famous for beautiful women and masculine men. That was what they turned out. And so the first couple days of school when I met everybody and it was like, I felt like I was in Avatar, like these glamazons, you know, they're just like 7 feet tall. And I'm in my, you know, I was a little bit of a hippie. I'm wearing like flannel and baggy jeans. You know what I mean? I'm like down here. And I was like, you know what? They didn't ask me to be an actor because I'm not beautiful like these people are. So I got a little chip on my shoulder. So for that 7 weeks, every time I was in acting class, I threw down as hard as I possibly could. And just, I didn't think anything would come of it. That wasn't my plan. I just didn't want to leave the room having anybody think I was less than, you know, like I wanted it to sort of be known that I was robbed. And so
you had something to prove. So you figured out how to do that.
And to myself, yeah. You know what I mean? Like I just, you know, being a great actor has nothing to do with beauty or glamour. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with it whatsoever. And I just wanted to fight that fight for myself. And so by the time Thanksgiving rolled around, all of a sudden the acting professors came to me and they're like, do you want to switch majors to, and I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. I hadn't really thought about that. you know, because in my mind I was an actor. So I said yes. And that's, so I graduated there with a BFA. And after 4 years, I went to New York City. And because William Morris, who was the huge agency, yeah. They were the CAA at the time, they picked me up. They hip pocketed me. And they said, they saw a little Leagues performance that we did. And the woman who brought me in, she said, look, we think you're great. We think you're the next Kathy Bates. You're not going to work till you're 40. And I was like, what? Yeah. I was like, that was like the best news and the worst news I'd ever heard in one sentence. And to some extent, they were right. Because back then, there were no, I mean, I looked really young at the time, but there were no, Nickelodeon wasn't around. There Absolutely. Were no chubby little yeah. cute girls on, you know, Dangerous Liaisons that, you know, Kirsten Dunst didn't have a chubby best friend. You know, like that boat was not sailing at the time. Now it's all over the place, you know.
Thankfully.
Body positivity is genuinely a new thing. And yes. I try to tell that to some of my younger students sometimes. I'm like, enjoy it, you guys, because did not exist. So I spent 4 years in New York doing, you know, a lot of theater, learning how to live, learning how to be an adult. And I think it is true. It's like, if you can make it there, you kind of have confidence that you can make it anywhere. After 4 years, I felt like I had burned the candle at both ends.
So is that where you developed your thick skin in New York?
Yeah, or? I think so.
I mean, it sounds like you already had a thick skin from day one, but regardless.
Yeah, I do. I think I you know, it's interesting because I did have a thick skin. I think that came from being a chubby kid, frankly. You know what I mean? You get, you know, and everything I did was sort of in spite of, because when you're an overweight kid and, you know, in the 80s and 90s, people like to let you know that your life is going to turn out terribly and that you're a loser from the get-go. Yeah. And I just knew that that was BS because I had been chubby literally. I think I was born at 6 pounds. Within a month, I was 12 pounds. Within 2 months, I was 24. Like, this story was from the get-go, you know? And so even, you know, when you're 6 or 7 as a young girl, people are already correcting you on what you're eating and what your weight is and all this sort of stuff. And I just intrinsically knew that I hadn't done anything wrong. And the idea that I had to deeply change myself in order to be worthy of love, I knew was BS, you know? And although I didn't know what to do about it because it was the whole society.
All you could do is be you.
Right. And so I developed a thick skin. And it wasn't until later in my 30s when I started getting into meditation that I had to deal with the other side of having a thick skin, which is you're not as vulnerable. You're guarded. You actually don't know yourself as well as you think you do because you've been in a defensive posture for so long. Mm-hmm. So that was a whole, you know, another great set of lessons I got to go through later on.
Do you find that process now is a conscious choice that you're making when it comes to being vulnerable, when it comes to letting the walls down, that it's a continuous conscious choice that you have to make because it's not your default?
That's right. It's not anybody's default, no. You know, and in fact, it's become a cornerstone of my teaching. When I first moved to LA. So after New York, I went back to Chicago and I said, I'm going to go there for 2 years. And I sort of made it my personal grad school. I made this intense list of what was working and what wasn't. And I said, and I had a lot of friends in LA, some who were doing very well, some who were super talented, couldn't get arrested. So I didn't want to be in that boat. So I did my best to call everybody, get any information I could so I could hit the ground running in LA. And so I went to Chicago. 2 years turned into 4 years. I got pretty seduced by the theater there. The theater in Chicago is fantastic. The people who are doing theater there are so smart. They all have day jobs, but they are amazing. And there's an audience. We would do shows in the dead of winter and have full houses.
Yeah, that's the support, the community support.
And the newspapers reviewed us. It's just a whole nother world there. Nobody made a living off of it. Now there's a little bit more production and stuff, but it's still not that much. So there's a bit of a glass ceiling as far as making money and supporting yourself fully as an actor. So I ticked all the boxes. I got an agent that bounced me to LA. I got in the union. You know, just like a little co-star job on ER was my first acting job. And I got that because I took a class with a casting director, you know, just like all the little things. And I often talk about the business of being an actor is like throwing darts in the dark. You don't know what's going to hit, but then something pops.
Yeah.
And you're not even sure how you made it happen. It just, but you have to do all these different things to drum up even the smallest thing. So that's what I was kind of doing. And then I got here in 2005. And I had this teacher who, I was in class one day here in LA and I was being grumpy. And he said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "Well, I feel like I'm going out for all these roles that are about making fun of me. They're about my body. Like they're, and I'm just like, that's just not what I do. I'm a strong actor. Like if you want a character to be funny, I'm a comedian. I'll handle it, right? But I don't want to be made fun of, you know?" And so he said, "You know what? Why don't you come Monday? Let's have a conversation, at, you know, in my office." I said, "I got that." So I met him on Monday and I learned so much from this guy. But one of the things he said to me in that meeting was, "You know, Emily, you're a great actress. There's no reason you shouldn't be working, but I never see you be vulnerable." And I immediately went to defend myself. And I don't know what your mind looks like on the inside, but mine is like has these file drawers. And so I rip open the drawer, you know, V for vulnerable. And there's nothing there. I'm like, it turns out I actually don't know what he's talking about. I don't have a definition of the word. And that was hard for me, you know. So I really spent the next couple of years figuring out what it meant to share my inner life, right? The part of me that is moved. The part of me that is universal, that everybody has. Like, no matter where you're born, what time period, what culture, what situation, we all have this similar inner core.
Yep.
And that's the part of us that is moved, right? Whether it's love, hate, ambition, jealousy, any of those things. And then to protect that, we all have an ego. Some you could call your personality. Like, there's different ways of talking about it. Like, babies don't have that protection. They're just pure vulnerability.
Yeah.
The only thing keeping babies alive is cuteness. That's it. Nothing else. They have no other defense system, right? But as we grow up, based on what we're taught, based on what happens to us, we learn to negotiate with the world. And that wall protects me from the world, but it also protects the world from me, by the way. You know, because sometimes there have been times where maybe a boss is being unfair and I would like to say a thing or two. And my editor comes in and thinks, "No, don't say that," right? And so I hide my inner life. I hide what I really think, right? Do you ever watch Dr. Brené Brown?
No.
Oh, okay. I highly
recommend been told it. Over and over again, you have to.
Well, this has to be the last time, so you should go Google her tonight.
I'm tell you where to start. Now.
Her, you know, Oprah did find her, so she got very popular.
Yes.
So there's a lot of Dr. Brené Brown out there, which is great. But her first TED Talk is worth finding. And
it's The first one.
The first one.
Okay.
And it's a really great place to start. And she gets into her whole story, but she gets into the nature of empathy versus sympathy.
Okay.
And the difference. And one, empathy is I feel with you, and sympathy is I feel sorry for you, right? And then she gets into the mechanism of vulnerability and how it really works. And it's so, it was so great to learn that because intrinsically I understood it as an actor, which is when I sit down to act across from you, if I open up and I give you access to my inner life, not only can you truly see me, but now my instincts can get back at you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not editing them. I'm not holding back. I'm not hesitating, right? So when I get vulnerable, it turns out you get vulnerable too, whether you want to or not,
mm-hmm.
right?
You're absolutely right.
And it makes so much sense because we live in a culture that doesn't have a ton of vulnerability. And that's okay. Every time I pump gas, I don't need to know how the guy at this pump next to me is feeling about his wife and his kids right now. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I just need to get on with my day. Like, I'm cool to be pleasant and happy.
But you have to have access. You need to have access.
But
to
as
that.
Actors, so then, well, so what do? Is we spend, you know, if we're lucky, we have one or two people who we can truly let our guard down around, right? But as human beings, we don't grow or process outside of relationship. So the best next thing is movies and TV. Have you ever accidentally met an actor and been like, "Oh, we know each other"?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
I did it when I first moved here. I was working at Starbucks and this guy comes in, crazy early morning rush. And I just heard his voice. I didn't even see him. And I look up and I'm like, "Hey," and he's not making that same face back at me. And this poor guy, I'm like, "It's me." And he's like, "I don't know if we know each other." And I'm like, "New York, Pittsburgh." I'm going through like every little town I've ever spent 20 minutes in, you know, and the line's getting angry, you know, people at 6 o'clock in the morning have no time for this. and then I was like, "Oh, okay." And then again, he said something when I wasn't looking at him and I realized he was an actor from 6 feet under.
There you
and
go.
I was so embarrassed, you know, but why would I do that? It's because he's a great actor, and he showed such vulnerability as his character.
He created a relationship with you.
That's right. That when I'm watching him, yes, I get vulnerable too. And those aspects of me that relate to his performance, I would come up and say, oh, me too. I know what loneliness is. I know what longing is. I know what love is. I know what wanting to defend people we care about, right? And I think I'm experiencing his story. But the truth is, I'm experiencing my own story, and that means something to me, that I'm in relationship. So, of course, I think we know each other. He's never seen my face before. I'm not sure he ever came back to that Starbucks. I may have scared him away.
I love that. I mean, it's funny because I have this idea of connection in my notes. Mm. So clearly that's something that we will continue talking about.
I hope so.
And it's interesting that you made a conscious choice to open up those portals of vulnerability.
Yeah.
As opposed to having life force you to do that. You know,
yeah,
lots of times people come up against tragedies,
yes,
that rip them open, good or bad, yeah, and now they're vulnerable.
Yeah.
Even when they didn't want to be.
I think it's a running joke that maybe we shouldn't tell civilians, but I think every true actor, when something terrible happens, and I genuinely don't care how bad it is, it could be you losing a parent to, like, there's some part of you going, remember this. Yeah. Oh. Remember what it means, right? Yes, there's some part of us, we can't help it.
I'll put it in my files.
Yeah, exactly. You put it in your
files. I'll have something in vulnerability.
Yeah, it's what I call, when I'm trying to teach this concept, it's what I call emotional resonance, because I don't want to reenact a tragedy that's happened in my life with a character.
No.
But what I can do is I can take some time to sit down and go into my memories and touch upon my memory of that experience. And usually you want to use something that isn't fresh, something that you've had some time to heal over. And it will reopen. Those memories are not far. And I'll just think, how is this, like, resonating in my body? Is it a pain in my gut? Does it make my shoulders? And I'll just literally notice how it feels. And then that's what I'll remember. It's like a, you know, barbershop quartet when they have a little pitch pipe,
yes,
right? It's like, do, 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 right? I think of that emotionally. And so I hear where this tone is for me. And then I sort of transfer that into what the character that I'm playing, and I just open that space, and then I start to fill it with the images and the connections and the meaning that the character has, and I give myself over to the imagination of that. But that's how I kind of open up the space to make sure that I drop deep enough into myself and that it means enough.
Do you ever lead with that space, meaning if you feel it in the heart, or if you feel it in the
sure,
you talk about chakras,
yeah,
you know, in the solar plexus, do you then ID the space and then navigate from that space?
Well, I think it depends on the character, because I find that characters are people, whichever, you know, they're the same. When someone's been hurt, they often have a lot of tension and protection around that space. So let's say that I had been brokenhearted. I might actually be the opposite. Mm. I might actually have a lot of defense around my shoulders, around here. I might actually kick my heart back. You know, and I will explore with the physicality of a character. Mm-hmm. I did do it. It's a little bit in True Detective, actually.
Lot of physicality.
Yeah, my posture is,
yes,
very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of at the point now where I'm not necessarily consciously thinking about it. I think it's almost like, you know, a mad painter experimenting. They know the colors so well that they allow themselves to move in an intuitive way. So I think I'm there now. I get more analytic about it when I'm teaching, when I'm trying to, you know, because acting is one of those professions that there are a lot of great books on it, but at some point you have to sit down with somebody who's just a little further on the road than you, who can kind of say, yes, you know, just communicate with you about what you're experiencing so that you can suss it out for yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do.
Raises the bar for you.
Yeah. It makes
Absolutely.
Me have to be conscious and analytic about what I do, intuitively, you know, and I developed a little bit of a catchphrase, because people are like, well, what kind of teaching do you do? And, you know, my style of acting and my style of teaching is totally eclectic. You know, it's Meisner, it's Stanislavski. I'll take whatever works, whatever somebody, and I've been in class my whole life. I love workshops. I love learning from other people. And so I keep all of that stuff.
So it's a kind of toolbox.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. You know, it was like before Harry Potter came along, we used to always imagine we had this expansive
yes.
toolbox that we would carry everything around. And, you know, if you wanted to go in there and take a walk, you could, you know, and then Harry Potter comes around and does it. And we're like, yeah, we already knew that. But so I'm constantly filling that up. And so the phrase that I use to sort of sum up where I'm at in the way that I'm trying, and this could change over the years, because I think actors are sort of interesting. We're the violinists and the violin. You know, we're playing our own instrument, and our instrument is changing. You know, me playing a role now, if I tried to play that same role 20 years ago, it would be a very different interpretation, and it should be. That's fair, you know. But the phrase that I use is, I train actors to have a wild confidence in their own experience, you know. And I love that word.
That's
wild.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
I love that word wild because
there's a freedom to
there's
that.
A freedom. And there's also an animalistic quality because we are animals.
Primitive.
And primitive. Exactly.
Which means it's already in you.
That's right. And so what I do is I try to train actors to momentarily turn away from the analytic or the ego or the editor. There's so many different ways of talking about it. Into the intuitive, to let that drive for the short amount of time. Because when you're in the intuitive, you actually... you take in more information, right? You're more curious than you are convincing. I'm more busy listening and feeling and understanding than I am trying to convince you of what I want you to think I am. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And if I can let more stimulus in and I have some level of vulnerability going on and that stimulus can get into the part that moves me, well, now I'm ready to just react to you. And now I have an effortless level of acting. And that's kind of what the camera demands because it reads thoughts.
Yes.
The camera
it's
is
just
so
right
close.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have time to like make that charming move. You know, you can't let anybody see your homework in that sense or see your choices. You just have to be living in the moment. Yeah.
We talked about this before the show started. When it comes to True Detective.
Yeah. I hope people are acting nerds because that's what we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, yes. Okay, how am I going to begin this? I had said to you, you know, I don't know whether to hate you or love you for making me watch the 8 shows of True Detective. It's so hard to put into words when... Why am I getting emotional? When you see that level of story...
Yeah.
When you see that level of performance, that's not a performance. It's a reflection of human condition.
Yeah. I think it's such a compliment that you're getting emotional. And I think it's a real comment on why True Detective is different from other mysteries or other series that are out there. And, you know, I've been talking to different people about this. And this is just my opinion. I don't know if the creators would agree with this or this is from being a participant, but also being a fan of the show, is that True Detective respects the human experience. Mm. It respects in how complex we are and that it's not just a crime that we're trying to solve. It's that we're all nagged by existential mysteries, by things that we may never have an answer to, but there's something about the human desire to know and to always, you know, to just chase this understanding. And, you know, I think it was one of the things that was hard. Okay, spoiler alert. So now we're getting into spoiler alert territory, everybody. So make your decision. I highly recommend if you have not seen the show, come back to us.
Yes.
But go watch it because they masterfully. I mean, I didn't get the whole script as the actor. I only got the parts that I was in. And so.
How do you prepare then? Mm-hmm. If you don't have the whole story, how can you? I guess you're preparing the moment. You're preparing the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there was a time there where I kept thinking, I'm like, are they going to give me more scenes? And it turns out that, you know, I am the one who's the dastardly one of everybody. Because of course, as an actor, I totally hope that I am. In real life, no. In shows, yes. I like to, what's my body count as an actor? I think I've killed 7 people in TV,
okay.
So I'm pretty.
That's impressive.
I went to school with Zachary Quinto, and he's a friend of mine and, back, you know, years ago. And I just did a TV show where I think I killed 6 people, you know. And I was so proud of myself, and I was being silly and bragging about it. And he had just finished playing Skyler on Heroes. He's like, I killed millions.
Oh, right.
Like, all right, you win.
Oh, he was amazing.
He's
I remember,
so
oh, my God, he's so good.
He's always such a great guy. Yeah.
I was looking at the cast list. Mm. Obviously, Mahershala Ali, Stephen Dorff. Mm. You play Margaret, best friends of Lucy Purcell, played by Mamie Gummer.
Yeah. Right.
Scoot McNairy.
Amazing.
Carmen Ayago.
Oh, my gosh.
Carmen, we hope that we're pronouncing your last name correctly.
That's true.
Right. Nick, you know, creator, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to probably butcher his last name, but Pizzolatto.
I know. You know, we'll I do feel that. So embarrassed because we'll I was on first
Nick.
Name basis with
everybody.
Everyone
knows him as Nick, the man with that mind.
Yeah.
that mind. And so I'm looking, you know, I saw the show, the cast list, and I'm thinking of you, and the song from The Sound of Music pops into my brain.
Which one?
Somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good to be a part of this experience.
Oh, yeah.
As not just as an actor, because I'm pretty darn sure that you walked away a different person.
Yeah.
After this experience.
Yeah. Well, I feel here's what's going to sound crazy about this. It was so easy. It was so easy. Walking onto set, everybody there just wasn't even a transition. Like, we were just hanging out between. It was just easy. Everybody there is so professional and so open, and their energy is so available that it was not difficult to immediately start believing that this was my, you know, my friend family, that these were the children that I cared about, that this was the world. We shot both on location and in sound stages. And so to be in Arkansas, the weather there is so intense.
So what time of year were you?
It was over 6 months, and I think they had some major rain, so we actually got pushed. So the schedules were all over the place. But their weather changes every 3 hours. It's crazy. Like, it would literally be 68 degrees at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then all of a sudden it's hailing, and then there's a windstorm, and then there's fog.
Kind of lends itself to the story.
It does. Yeah. There were some shots in there. There's a great shot of them all out in hayfield looking for the kids in one of the earlier episodes, and there's just this fog rolling in.
Yes.
And I met the post-production, I forget her name offhand, but it was this great lady. I met her at the premiere, and I was asking her about that. I assumed that it was CGI, you know, that they had come in and enhanced it. She goes, oh, no, that was that night.
And Nick talks about that. He says the landscape was a character.
It really was.
Yeah,
people
ask
me
that.
How I prepared for the role. I'm like, I spent time outside. I spent time in the bookstores. I went and found as much sort of first-person Arkansas literature as I could just to get the language. I talked to people. I just went for walks, basically, and would chat up anybody who was willing to talk to me, you know, and just try to absorb it and try to blend into that world because particularly, you know, Margaret, she's got this line where she says, you know, somebody's got to remember. You know, and
that just crushed me.
Yeah. And that's what she's doing is she is somebody who's had a part of the beginning of that scene was written, but it didn't make the final cut of the show. So I have a little bit more information on Margaret than the audience got. But, you know, she never had kids. She never married. She lost her best friend. She was the support system to this dysfunctional family.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And in some level, she set aside her own happiness to be a part of theirs, and it crumbled around her. And so by the time everybody's gone but her, she feels her identity is wrapped up in who these people were, and that somebody loved somebody, and that somebody mattered. And I think that she's such a brokenhearted person that to let go of that last bit would mean to have no identity.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to stop existing as a person. And so the idea is that Shoepick Lane, which was once a thriving community, over time because of factories closing, and that's true of that general, that there are a few people who they don't have any reason to leave. And so they stay. And so the art direction did a great job on Margaret's house. And when you see her the second time in the 1990s, you know, she's a hoarder for, you know, lack of a better word, but she's kept everything.
Memories.
She's kept all the memories. Proof that these people were here. Proof that they mattered.
Let's talk about this idea of connection. It was interesting that this morning I was getting ready for work. And did you see the Oscars?
I did.
Okay.
Well, not all of it. In pieces. So
okay.
Depends on what you're going to do.
So it was Bradley and Gaga's moment.
Yes, I did. Yes.
So, you know, I saw it at the Oscars and I react the way I always react when they sing together. I cried.
Yeah.
So I thought of the song this morning.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I'm just going to watch that moment again. So I went on YouTube and watched that moment and I'm crying.
Yeah.
And I took a step back. Like, why am I so emotional? What is it about? Is it the song? What is it? And their connection. Mm-hmm. As two artists,
mm-hmm. Here I go again. Yeah, do it. Bring it on.
Their connection as artists, the song, the circumstances, you know, obviously with the film, the message that the film has about mental illness mm-hmm. and depression. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, the power of connecting with That's someone right. else. And you brought this up earlier, yeah. you know, when in regards to, you know, when you're going to school and the power, the need to connect. And with True Detective and Margaret and everyone else's story, the memories, mm-hmm. connecting the past with the present, mm-hmm. how it affects the future. Mm-hmm. All of this was going through my brain. Mm. It's like, it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. The power of connection. Mm-hmm. It all makes sense.
And it's interesting because in the final episode, Ali's character and Carmen's character sort of for the, they have a flashback, I think to the 1990s. And he says, our entire relationship is based around these two dead kids.
And when you were talking about your character, when you were talking about your character, Margaret,
right.
She's holding on to that.
Yeah.
Yet they were saying,
We need to let this go.
We need to let it go because right. that's our whole relationship has been about exactly. this tragedy.
And truthfully, Margaret should have let it go too. You know, Margaret should have found somebody to love her. And for whatever reason, she didn't find them, you know, whether it's because of where she lived or because of how she felt about herself or whatever the case is. But she was a lonely woman, you know. And so I just think it's really interesting. It's one of the things I like about this season is that it really questioned whether or not the search is always worth it, you know, and whether or not it matters.
What's being sacrificed along the way.
Exactly. Exactly. Is it, you know, we chase things like a dog chasing a rabbit or something. And is it just because it feels important doesn't mean that it is, you know?
And Stephen Dorff's character, you know, ends up with no one.
Right.
And no children. And right. he says that to Wayne.
Right.
Ali's character. Because Wayne did take a step back and left.
That's right.
He put his family first.
That's right. Yeah. I would have liked more information about what happened to Carmen's character.
That was interesting because so many things were tied up nicely.
Yeah.
I was really satisfied, but we don't know what really happened right. to her. I mean, she died.
That's all we know.
We get that, but we don't get the how.
I kept thinking I missed it, but then I don't think so. I
don't believe we ever got the how. And mm-hmm. I that had to have been intentional.
Right.
Why?
You know what else is weird? Nobody says my name the entire show.
When I was reading about your character, your name was always in quotes. And I thought, no one ever says Margaret. Mm-mm. There's no last name.
Mm-mm. There's no last name. Margaret. And I'm just literally, nobody even says Margaret.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're just there.
This is the strangeness of my career is that the more I do this, the smaller my roles get and the more I get paid. I can't explain. It's not the way I want it. I mean, don't get me wrong.
All that hard work. Really?
Right? I'm just like, and I'm always mistaken for crew or a local every time. Like, I'm so, you know, you just don't necessarily, you don't see me coming. I blend into the background. But
it's your superpower.
Yeah, it's my superpower. Yeah. But, you know, I kind of hate when people say, like, oh, you play real people. I'm like, no, this is called being a character. that's all it is. But, it's so funny. Like everybody, for some reason, people always think I'm not in costume, and it kept happening. And I was like, "Really? You think I came to set in this polyester matching jumpsuit right now? Is that what you think? Emily Nelson, the actress, is when I'm hanging out in these itchy clothes? Just cause. That's so crazy to me. But now I forgot what I said because I just think it's so funny. I don't remember.
Well, you were saying the smaller the roles.
Oh, yeah. So I am just there. And so at one point, this is a true story. So I'm on set. They've flown me to Arkansas, right? I went back and forth many times. And they were sort of giving me the script piecemeal as it came.
And everyone was like that?
I think so. Because when we were first, I mean, I'm sure Ali got the script all the way through. Because I think it's so complex and maybe Carmen, but I really don't know, to be honest. But I know when I was first on set with Mamie, at some point I leaned over and I said, hey, can I ask you some questions? Because I'm not entirely sure about what's going on here. I didn't get the whole script.
That is hysterical.
And she goes, me neither. And I was like, what? I was like, you're Meryl Streep's daughter. Like, isn't it in your contract?
And it's not like she had a small.
No, she had a huge role.
Yeah.
So I think what happened with her and Scoot was that they were offered the scripts as it came and they could decide whether or not they wanted to see it. So I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I don't know that exactly.
But fascinating.
We were, you know, the first episode or two, we shot kind of out of order, like a film, like everything was. So we'd be doing parts from episode 6 and episode 1. So it was all mixed
up. What was the first scene that you shot? I was really curious.
Well, not only is the first scene I shot, but it's the first scene of the entire production was me taking down the Halloween decorations in the beginning when I see the kids go by. So that was the first shot of the whole season that we all got together to shoot. But yeah, we were sort of like, we were playing Clue. We're like, is it the mother in the living room? We had no idea. She didn't know if she'd done it.
Why do you think Nick did that?
So that we don't anticipate, so that we're in the mystery as well. And, you know, you had mentioned before, like, was it hard to prepare? And like, at first I was I felt a little grubby. I was like, I want all the answers. Give it to me, you know? But the truth is, it's like, I worked on Maid of Honor like 10 years ago and they were rewriting that script every day. Yeah. I'd get new jokes and new lines. If you work on a sitcom, they're rewriting.
That's part of the deal.
It's part of the deal. Yeah. And so I thought, you know, and these days, like a lot of guest stars or co-stars that you go out for, I mean, when you get the audition, you only get that little bit of scene. So you, and this is where it sort of overlaps with improvising a little bit, is if they don't tell you, you have to figure it out or make something up that makes sense, because a lack of specificity as an actor reads as non-interesting and non-engaging.
Exactly.
So even if you're wrong, you just have to make a choice.
Yeah.
And so that's just kind of what I did. And they seemed to like what I was doing. So I let it be. But anyway, so they brought me down. So I go to hair and makeup. They bring me to the set and they said, okay, listen, we're just finishing up this last scene and then you're in the next one. But they want to just go into the house and they're giving direction for the next setup. I said, okay, great. So I go in there and I hadn't met Nick at all. And so he's in there and he wasn't on set very often.
Okay.
And he, or at least when I was there. So, you know, I was only there a small portion. But so he's talking to Mamie and Scoot and the director, Jeremy, about what's going on, da, da, da. And he's like, okay. And he goes, and Margaret's here. And he just nods to me, points to me, and I nod. And then he leaves, you know, and we're like, okay. Now I have no lines in the scene. So when we come back and we're actually setting up to do the scene, I had a question. So I went to the director and I said, hey, you know, what do you think about this and this? So he opens up his sides to kind of look at the scene to answer my question. And he's flipping through and he goes, are you in this scene? I'm literally not listed. I was like, it doesn't even say Margaret sitting on the couch. Like, I'm literally not listed in the scene. And I just looked at him. I said, they flew me to Arkansas.
I'm here.
In polyester. I don't know what to tell you. Like, the guy just nodded to me. I'm here somewhere. So you understand my questions. I'm like, I don't know. I guess you don't either.
That's just fantastic.
Yeah. So, but it was, it just all worked out. It was fine. It was really, it just seemed to fit itself together piece by piece. And I never felt like I didn't know. I felt like I knew what I needed to know.
What did you walk away with? What did you add to your toolbox?
Oh, that's a good question. What did I? This may sound silly, but I think in some ways just confidence in myself. I feel like I'm a character actor, and I haven't really. When I first moved to LA, I got lucky, and I was playing pretty big roles. Mm-hmm. It was before the recession hit, and things seem to have shifted since then. But like I said, my roles are these funny. I feel like I get paid to come on set and not be directed. You know what I mean? Like, they're like, let's just bring in Emily because she knows what she's doing. And, you know, it's like, I'm not the lead character, but I'm also not, I'm playing roles that require somebody who knows what they're doing. And so I was kind of left to my own devices, you know? And I think I came away confident in myself.
Even more so.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as actors, we never know. I offer up takes of things, but the show is made in the editing room. So I don't know how it's going to, I don't know what pieces they're going to choose. I don't know how they're going to structure the story. I don't know exactly what angle they're catching me from. So I have to have a lot of faith in the people I'm working with. And in this case, I had a ton of faith. So, you know, it's like I call them golden tissues. You know, it's like I give them a set of options that I'm fully committed to. And it's this amazing creation. And they say, no, not that one. You're like, great. Here's another golden tissue. Like, you just have to keep offering up things that are just as valid and committed as the time before. But you can't be precious about it. You know, you just have to keep offering up new moment after new moment. And so that's what I did.
What did you glean from Mamie?
Easiness. She's easy, man. She's kind. She's calm. There's no extra buzz around her. You know, our conversation was chill and jovial. She's just cool.
It's just, you know, her work on this show is just so painful.
Yeah.
it's so painful to watch.
Yeah.
And she, there was no hesitation on her part. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could tell she was there full throttle, like in it.
Yep. Yep. And it was just like that, like I said, for whatever reason, it was easy to immediately be heartbroken. It was easy to immediately want to protect her. You know, I don't know why. But
there was a moment, I don't remember which scene, but the two of you were sitting on the couch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the detectives came in and had questions and she was starting to get upset and you got mm-hmm. protective of her. And I think you leaned in,
mm-hmm.
you know, just in that moment of, are you okay? And she reached out and touched your hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then immediately got up to walk into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But it was just that moment between the two of you that obviously resonated with me. It's like the relationship between these two women.
Well, we had the emotional relationship. Her and Scoot did not. You know what I mean? Their marriage was strained. She and I had, you know, later on there's a scene where there's a news conference and they're sort of, the police are saying you know, and she and I are sitting together. Scoot's, you know, they're estranged at this point and probably before the show starts. So, and you know, it's not the healthiest
thing.
There was a seat between the two of them, but I'm right there with her. And where she goes, I go. She runs off. I chase her. I chase her car running out, you know.
Oh, that's with Carmen. That's right, the two of you in the parking lot.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, I'd say there's a little bit of codependency between the two of them in a way. It's like she could be, you know, and this is backstory that's not included in the final thing, but we met working at the chicken plant and I worked there for 15 years. And so that, you know, there's a lot in there in a character to work in a chicken plant in a difficult blue collar job like that takes a toll on a person's body.
As women, mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a toll on your mind. Those places do not have windows. Like it's a hard life. You know, and I was jealous of her. I was jealous of her because she was beautiful and she got all I ever wanted was a family. And I think even though I don't say that in the final version, you see that. And so I was living vicariously through her. And so part of me loved her and part of me was angry with her.
Resentful.
And I will have to say, this is a funny detail about me. When I moved here in 2005, my best friend, she was a successful actress and she'd moved out here before me. And she was always like, Emily, get out here. And I kept being like, no, not until I get, you know, my sort of ducks in a row and this and that. And I was supposed to move here in March of 2005. And she passed away in February.
Oh, my gosh.
Out of nowhere. And so I arrived the day that she left. And so for me to book a job about losing my best friend and was not that hard for me. So when we talk about emotional resonance. And she was my best. Her name was Nicole DeHuff. She was in Meet the Parents, the original one. So a lot of people know her from that. And she was just the coolest person I ever met in my life to this day. She's amazing. And so that wasn't hard for me. So maybe that's part of why I booked that role is because I understood.
Yeah.
I understood what that meant.
You resonated.
Yeah.
You resonated.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could go on talking for another 2 hours here.
What?
Quickly want to bring up your acting school.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you've spoken a lot about being a teacher and how important that is.
Yeah. I didn't think it would be, by the way. I really resisted it for a long time.
Did you?
Well,
so were people telling you need to be a teacher?
Constantly. Yeah. Because after the recession hit, I sort of had a little bit of a breakdown as an actor because I suddenly couldn't get cast. But I didn't realize that all of Hollywood had shrunk. Like I thought it was me. And then also I should say, oddly enough, after Maid of Honor, I made the mistake of going online and seeing what people thought.
Oh, my.
And yeah. And so when you say you had a thick skin, I did have a thick skin, but not one oriented to the internet because I didn't grow up with it.
Yes.
And there was just pages upon pages upon pages just making fun of my body. And I wasn't ready for it. So it hurt me. It did. You know, you have to learn how to like navigate that stuff a little bit. So I was in a really vulnerable place. So I went around to every acting teacher in LA being like, fix me. Something's wrong. And they're all like, you want to teach the class? Like, I don't know what to tell you. And I had this idea that those who teach can't do. And finally, a friend of mine, Chris Connor, who plays Poe on Altered States. I'm just name dropping left and right, mostly because I'm proud of my friends. We've been doing this a long time. I've known them since we were 16. So there's a lot. I'm so proud of everybody. He's the one that made me go teach. He found this thing. He said, just apply. And so I did. And it was this David Kagan studio, and he became my mentor, and I learned to teach from him.
That's great.
And when he retired, I opened my own school, which is just called Acting Class with Emily Nelson, ACEN. So
ACEN.
Yeah, ACEN. Of course, when GPS says it.
You said
it
sounds... you're going on hiatus for
I am.
A little bit,
yeah.
Teaching-wise.
My group classes are going on hiatus just because things are sort of picking up, and I need my time a little bit more. But I'm still coaching individually and things like that.
Okay.
So you can still find me if you need me.
Before we wrap up, have you heard of the Proust questionnaire?
I have. What is okay. The New Yorker that does it at the end?
Who the
does
Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair.
Vanity
that's
Fair.
Right.
Okay. So pick a number 1 to 35.
Oh, great. Let's do 29.
All right.
I'm so nervous.
Which historical figure do you most identify with?
Ooh, who do I identify with? Historical figure. I don't know the answer to that question. I want to see Bessie Smith, but I can't even tell you why. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Janis Joplin.
Mm.
You know, just as far as taking the hard knocks and
yeah,
and kind of just screaming in everybody's
just
face.
Just being
anyways.
Unapologetically her.
Yeah.
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 That's good.
Yeah.
That's a hard question.
You picked
a tough one.
Thank you.
I
did. Whoops. How about my favorite color? Green.
Before we wrap up once more, where can people find you on social media?
On Instagram, I'm the real Emily Nelson. Is that right? I have to look to other people because I don't know. And then on Twitter, I am Emily_Nelson. And Facebook, I think if you just Google Emily Nelson.
Okay, great.
Although there's millions of us.
You can find me on Twitter at Tammy Gouveia and Instagram, Facebook, Tammy Gouveia Official. This has been amazing. I wish we had another hour. You'll just have to come back.
I will. Anytime.
You know,
so fun.
Get booked on something.
I mean,
and come back soon, please.
Working on it.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.